From the
Right.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Werke, and Judge Smith. The Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is June 27, 2023. This panel of the court today has three cases set for oral argument, all of them using the Zoom video conferencing application. The first case set for oral argument today is number A22-1709, State of Minnesota versus Chase Jeffrey Boggs. As counsel probably know, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. You should be able to see a time clock on your screen if you're using the gallery view or some other similar view, and that will show you the time remaining in your argument. I think that is enough preliminaries. Counsel for appellant, you may introduce yourself and your client and then begin your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors, opposing counsel. May it please the court. My name is Zachary Webster, and I represent appellant Chase Boggs in this matter, who is not appearing for the record. Your Honors, this case is a case about insufficient facts to prove count two of the complaint, domestic assault, intent to cause fear of bodily harm. In this matter specifically, we are challenging that there's insufficient evidence to prove that Mr. Boggs had any intent to cause MG fear of bodily harm in this case. With regards to domestic assault, intent to cause fear, that is a specific intent crime, as stated in State v. Fleck. And so in order to prove that, there needs to be circumstantial evidence to support that. So the review the court needs to use is the silver nail consideration in this case, which considers the circumstances consistent with the verdict of step one, and then determine whether those circumstances are inconsistent or consistent with guilt and inconsistent with any rational hypothesis except that of guilt in this case. The circumstances proven in this case do not support that there was any do not support guilt in this matter. The circumstances proven, as shown in the respondent's brief specifically, is that MG and appellant had broke up prior to the assault and were not getting along. That's clear in the record. They weren't getting along. They had prior disputes, as shown in their num in respondents number two, which is that appellant ha they had ang that he had had anger. There were incidents testified regarding punching a hole in a wall and punching a bed near MG. However, those were specifically relationship evidence, and the court properly instructed the jury that they should not consider that specifically for guilt in this case. And so it can only be considered that the parties did not get along and that there were arguments and disputes. The third fact, and I think the most important one for the court, is the actual act that respondent is saying that Mr. Boggs did, which is that appellant grabbed MG by the arm and dropped her on the floor. And then number four, that MG felt pain when appellant grabbed her. And I think it's important with regards to Silvernair, which specifically says to only consider circumstances consistent with the verdict, that the verdict isn't just count two, what Mr. Boggs was found guilty of, but also count one, domestic assault inflicting bodily harm, which Mr. Boggs was acquitted of by the jury. And so when
There
you
wasn't any, there was absolutely no indication that there was bodily injury. I mean, aren't we talking simply the fear that the victim in this case testified to?
We are talking about the fear, Your Honor. That is correct. But we also have to look, what was the act that my client did that was intended to cause her fear? And when you have number four on respondents that MG felt pain.
Well, what the circumstantial evidence and what was proven. I mean, he's quite a bit larger than her. He testified, the jury obviously disregarded, did not believe him, and they chose to believe her. The early morning hours, the fact that they hadn't slept. I mean, these are all things that support the verdict.
These are all things that support a verdict, but also support a rational hypothesis of innocence, Your Honor, which is that the parties were just having a dispute over who was going to take care of the minor baby in the morning. Prior to the baby woke up, MG was taking care of the baby right away. My client came out with a dog, which woke the baby up again right when she put her to sleep and went to his bedroom. And then she went to give him the baby prior to any of this actions. There was no statements from my client that were in the record about any intent to cause fear of harm. There were no threats. There was no loud noises. All I think that MG stated was that
the slamming of the sliding door with the dog, that was a loud noise, wasn't it?
It was a loud noise, but it wasn't intended to cause alarm, as count three disorderly conduct Mr. Boggs was also acquitted of, and that was the only loud noise that was there, and that wasn't enough even for a disorderly, according to the jury in this case. All it did was wake up the baby. It was no intention or action towards Miss Guidel. In fact, the only time he commented after that towards Miss Guidel was saying that since everybody's up, the baby can be awake. And so none of those acts were directed towards Miss Guidel. None of them went towards the fear of harm in this case. And so when we go towards what is bodily harm, it means physical pain, injury, illness, or any impairment of a person's physical condition. When you talk about the fact that MG says she felt pain, that clearly is saying she had bodily harm. And so that is not a circumstance proven in this case. So number four of respondent's brief has to be, had to have been thrown out by the jury. And then with regards to grabbing appellant's arm, there's that action, which can be an innocent action if it didn't cause any pain. So that would be the one only action that Mr. Boggs did. And then there's the dropping her, lifting her and dropping her on the floor, which would also be considered bodily harm, because that would be an impairment of a person's physical condition, because they're lifted off the air, they can't move, they can't walk, and they're dropped. That has to also be considered an assault that the jury did not believe happened, because it would be inconsistent with the verdict in finding Mr. Boggs not guilty of count one. So the only act that was proven in this case that the court should be considering the circumstances proven is that Mr. Boggs grabbed Miss Guidel's arm based off of the respondent's brief. After that, she felt fear of what appellant might do, and that's when she called 911. And
Mr. Webster, can I stop you there? I guess I'm wondering, do you have any, I mean, I understand that you're making a separate argument about inconsistent verdicts, and now you seem to be saying, trying to use the verdict on a different count as a way of determining or shaping the circumstances proved. And I'm not aware of case law that sort of authorizes that way of analyzing circumstantial evidence. Is there any case law?
So, Your Honor, supporting that? I believe there is. State v. Silvernail specifically says, and when doing this, the court needs to consider circumstances consistent with the verdict, which, and as I'm sure the court is aware, a verdict isn't just a verdict for one count, it's a verdict for all of the counts in this case. And so I believe that implies specifically that the court has to consider all of the verdict in this case. And I believe a case cite from the respondent's brief, State v. Leak, the fact of the court has to assume the fact finder disbelieved any testimony conflicting with that verdict. And so if there's a verdict with three counts and they have count one in this case of domestic assault, intent to cause bodily harm, which is an acquittal, count three, disorderly conduct, that's an acquittal, and count two, domestic assault, intent to cause fear, that's a conviction. The court has to, when they're looking at the facts in this case, the court can't add a fact that would have made him guilty of count one, because otherwise the jury would have found him guilty of count one, and that wouldn't be a circumstance consistent with that verdict, because you have to look at the entire verdict.
I appreciate that response to my question. I'm wondering whether in a case in which three charges are submitted to the jury, do we refer to the jury's decisions on all three counts in the singular or the plural? Is that a single verdict or are there three verdicts?
I would say you consider them in the singular, Your Honor, because I think that the jury, when they're told to consider each count separately, but it's all part of the jury's verdict. The jury is determining what actually happened in this case, and the only way that we get any insight of what they determine happened is through their decisions on guilty or not guilty in those verdicts. And so this is all one case. There was all one complaint. And so when the jury provides a verdict on all of the counts, that is their verdict for all of this entire case. It's one verdict for the whole case. And that has, in this case, acquittals and a not guilty in this case. So the court has to consider all of it. And so when we go through that, the only action that has been proven, the circumstances that my client grabbed her arm while she was laying on the couch, is that she felt fear, that she called 911, and that her shirt was wrinkled, which would suggest he grabbed her arm by the couch because that would have wrinkled it. As they stated that he never touched MG, which would be, I guess, inconsistent, but as you already stated, you don't consider what my client's testimony is in this case, and that she didn't want to testify. Those are the facts that the state has relied on to say that my client, those are the circumstances proved that he was guilty of count two. And so when we take those circumstances and consider the rational hypothesis of guilt and whether there's any rational hypothesis that's inconsistent with guilt, there is a rational hypothesis inconsistent with guilt. That's that my client, Mr. Boggs, was not intending to cause Ms. Guidel fear of harm. It's that he was intending to make sure she was awake to give her the baby. That was his intent. And this is very clear when you look at the circumstances of this entire case. The parties woke up because of the baby. Ms. Guidel was frustrated because the baby wouldn't fall asleep. Ms. Guidel went straight to Mr. Boggs to give him the baby when he was in bed wanting to be asleep, to say, you have to take care of him if you want him awake. My client never threatened, never raised his voice, only had an angry tone because now he has to take care of the baby that he didn't want to early in the morning because they were tired. And so instead of going forward and wanting to cause Ms. Guidel fear of harm, all he wanted to do was go over, wake her up, and give her the baby because he wanted her to take care of the baby because he had to get ready for work. Even Ms. Guidel said she wanted him to get ready to work and go, even though she didn't take the baby. And immediately after this incident, she was not really afraid of Mr. Boggs because Mr. Boggs went back to his room with the child when she said she called 911. She didn't act as if she was afraid and stay on 911 and stay away from him. She actually followed him back into his room and asked specifically for the child back, and he said no. And so, and that's when she was told to leave by the 911 operator. So show her actions that she says didn't get there. That's a clear rational hypothesis that's consistent with all the circumstances proven that Mr. Boggs' intent was not to actually cause fear of harm to Ms. Guidel when he grabbed her arm while she was laying on the couch, but merely that he was intending to wake her up to give her the baby. And so with that, it's clear under the Silvernail standard that there is insufficient evidence under count two to find Mr. Boggs guilty of this offense, or find Mr. Boggs guilty of this offense, and the jury, with that insufficient facts, the court has to reverse and find him not guilty on count two in this matter. Our second argument in this case, Your Honor, is specifically that if the court does not find that it's insufficient, that these are inconsistent and that Mr. Boggs should have a new trial. I think it's clear, as I spent a lot of time already talking about these inconsistencies, that the facts in this case of one specific action, one specific act, make this inconsistent. This was only one incident that occurred that Ms. Guidel talked about. This wasn't a fight that had multiple scenes within the whole incident. There was only one. And so by finding Mr. Boggs not guilty of the actual domestic assault, which has a lower intent standard than the domestic assault intent to cause fear, and that rejects those facts entirely of the actual physical incident that occurred in this case, that makes these verdicts inconsistent, and therefore the court does not find to reverse and find Mr. Boggs not guilty due to the insufficient evidence. The court has to remand for a new trial due to the inconsistencies in this case. Thank you, Your Honors. Do you have any further questions for me about my argument?
Just one about what is the size of your client? I understand he's quite a large man.
I believe the record said that he was over 6 feet tall. I'm sorry, I don't have the specific number in the transcript in front of me.
I thought he was 6'6" or something like that.
That was my recollection, Your Honor.
Tell me what the rational basis is for lifting somebody off the ground to wake them up.
Your Honor, I don't believe that's consistent with the circumstances proven in this case that he lifted up Ms. Guidel and dropped her on the floor. But if the court were to find that is a circumstances, if she was waking up and he lifted her to be in a sitting position instead of a laying down position, that normally wakes somebody up a little bit more than if they're just laying down in this case. However, as the fact specifically that the state is referencing that he lifted her up and dropped her off of the floor, Your Honor, which I am.
Well, now you're saying lifted her up. Your argument, throughout your argument, Mr. Webster, you referred to it as grabbing her. There's a difference between placing somebody in a sitting position and grabbing someone. So if that's the testimony that she was grabbed, that puts it in a different light for the jury, doesn't it?
It does, Your Honor. And I'm relying on the state's facts here that they provided in their brief, which is that she grabbed her by the arm and dropped her on the floor. And I guess in order to have dropped her on the floor, she had to have been lifted up. And I believe she testified that he grabbed her, lifted her, and then dropped her. And the lifting and the dropping, Your Honor, which is specifically what Ms. Guidel testified to, would be physical bodily harm because it's an impairment of her body as she's lifted off of the ground. She's not able to use her body as she wants. And it, as she stated in her testimony, it caused her physical pain. And so the only circumstance of the act that my client has that is consistent with the verdict is that he grabbed her arm. And so our argument is that the jury has rejected the lift and drop of her.
I thought there was actually direct evidence that her shirt or whatever she was wearing was all scrunched up. The officer testified indicating that it had perhaps been the way and manner in which he grabbed her.
Your Honor, I'm out of time. May I answer the question or respond to that?
Yes, you may.
Yes, Your Honor. That is what the testimony is. And if he would have grabbed her arm, as I'm saying, that would also have caused that wrinkle. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Webster. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may introduce yourself and your client and then begin your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors and Mr. Webster. May it please the court. My name is Lacey Schumacher. I am an assistant city attorney for the city of New Ulm. I'm appearing on behalf of the city of New Ulm as the respondent in this matter. I'm going to make 2 points today. First is on the argument regarding the sufficiency of the evidence to establish guilt on count two in this case. And second is on the issue of whether the verdicts are legally consistent or not. As Mr. Webster indicated, the jury found the appellant guilty of domestic assault fear. Testimony of MG at trial showed that the appellant picked MG up and dropped her after grabbing her by the arm, as Mr. Webster stated. MG specifically stated during the trial that she was afraid that the appellant would continue to act violent, and so she called 911. She specifically said, "I didn't know what was going to happen next." Circumstantial evidence shows that the appellant's escalating pattern of behavior gave her reason to fear him. As Mr. Webster pointed out, relationship evidence had been introduced that previous to the date in question, the appellant had punched a hole in the wall during an argument, the hole being near her head during the argument, and then punched a pillow again that was near her head while she was laying in the bed. It's rare for a person to say, "I'm going to hurt you" or "I'm going to scare you now." It's more common for them to act on that. In order to convict, the jury had to believe that MG and not the appellant's testimony. Viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the conviction, the court must uphold their determination because the facts in the record could and did allow a jury to reasonably conclude that appellant was guilty of domestic assault fear beyond a reasonable doubt. It's a complete chain of evidence that leads so directly to guilt as to exclude any other reasonable inference. For example, as one of your honors pointed out, nothing in the record gave an alternate reason for the appellant to grab MG by the arm, lift her up, and drop her on the floor. There's this new theory that he did so to wake her up or to move her into a sitting position, but those facts are not in the record, and they were not presented to the jury. All the testimony showed that MG was not asleep at the time that the appellant went to grab her. She testified that he pursued her immediately, that she had not fallen asleep, and grabbed her by the arm. It was so immediate that there were no words exchanged before he did that. If the court applies the analysis that Mr. Webster pointed out, accepts the state evidence and rejects any evidence not consistent with the state's case, then the circumstances proved are inconsistent with any other rational hypothesis other than guilt. turning to my second argument, the verdicts are legally consistent. The appellant's argument is based on a misguided interpretation of the jury's verdict. According to the appellant, in order for the jury to have acquitted on domestic assault harm, that means that not only no harm occurred, but that no act occurred. One of your honors got to this in your questions during the appellant's argument, that the act of grabbing the appellant's arm could either have harmed her or have caused her fear. In order for the jury to find what they did, they believed that the appellant had no intention to harm her when he grabbed her arm, but did so in order to cause her fear. The leap of logic that the appellant is asking the court to make would substitute the will of the court for the jury's actual intention in rendering their verdict. The evidence that the jury heard still exists, even if they acquitted on one count and convicted on another. In other words, the acts that the appellant actually committed happened, whether or not the jury found that those actual actions harmed MG. It isn't that they didn't think he did it, it's that they didn't think he did it with the intent to cause harm. Alternatively, in acquitting on counts 1 and 3 and convicting on count 2, the jury could have been using the power of lenity discussed in State v. Newman and split the baby, for lack of a better term. The jury was explicitly told in the instructions that they were given that they could convict on all, some, or none of the counts that were presented to them, and so they did. I'll note that the defense brief cites to State v. Moore and State v. Christensen for the proposition that, and I'll quote here, a legally inconsistent verdict requires that two guilty verdicts be mutually exclusive. And that's obviously not the situation here. The situation here is one guilty verdict and two not guilty verdicts. So this situation is just not covered by the case law on legally inconsistent verdicts. It may be logically inconsistent, or it may have been the jury's power of lenity, but it doesn't fall in the case law that requires reversal for legally inconsistent verdicts. The state in this case respectfully requests that this court affirm the jury's verdict and affirm the court's ruling that the verdicts were legally consistent. I have nothing else to add. Unless there are any questions, I will yield the remainder of my time.
It appears that there are no further questions. Thank you, Ms. Schumacher.
Thank you.
Mr. Webster, you have an opportunity for rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, opposing counsel. Respondent mentioned the intent of Mr. Boggs, and I think it's important for the court to recognize the differences between intent in count one and intent in count two. For domestic assault, intent to cause bodily harm, it's actually a general intent crime. So all that's required for the intent is that Mr. Boggs intended to cause the act itself and cause the bodily, and that caused the bodily harm. Not that he intended to cause bodily harm, just that he had the intent to do the specific act, and then that act caused bodily harm in this case. I think that's an important distinction as we look at the intent to inflict fear of bodily harm that the state is arguing for this matter, as the intent to cause fear of bodily harm is a specific intent crime, and that specific intent requires that Mr. Bogg, when he did the action of grabbing Ms. Guidel's arm, did so intending to cause her fear of bodily harm, which doesn't seem to be consistent with the circumstances proven in this case, as if we have to reject count one, that he didn't do this act intending to cause her harm, or that it didn't cause her harm, it makes it difficult to use that circumstance to then say that when he grabbed her arm, he did so with the intent to cause her fear of harm when it didn't actually cause her harm, as the court can't consider in count one. And that leads to, again, the rational hypothesis of innocence in this case, which is very clear with the circumstances surrounding the argument of who was going to take care of the baby. And he's grabbing her arm to wake her up to give her the baby. That's all I have. I yield my time unless there are further questions on rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Can you remind me, Mr. Webster, about the evidence of bodily harm? Was there actual bodily harm?
Your Honor, the specific evidence of actual bodily harm was Ms. Guidel's direct testimony that she felt pain when she was grabbed and dropped. And so that testimony would have to be rejected by the jury, specifically because the jury acquitted on count one, domestic assault causing bodily harm in this case.
Does bodily harm include pain?
Yes, it does. The court instructed the jury, and this is on page 192 of this transcript, that bodily harm means physical pain or injury, illness, or any impairment of a person's physical condition. And so,
am I correct in remembering that the officer did not see any injuries or lasting?
That is correct.
Visible injuries?
That is correct, Your Honor. He did not see any injuries. I believe Ms. Guidel testified that there was a red mark on her arm afterwards, which would have been rejected by the court, as that would have been some sort of mark or injury. And then the court and the jury had to reject her testimony that she actually felt bodily harm in the injury in this case in order to acquit on count one. Are there any further questions from the court?
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Webster. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in this case within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honor.